And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, we've been joined in studio by Adrian Weckler, technology editor with the Irish and Sunday Independent. And there's quite a little bit. Well, no, there's more than a little bit. There's a commitment in the papers today for the country and national broadband plan. And this week saw the Secretary of the Department of Communications, Mark Griffin, come before the Public Accounts Committee to answer questions on the plan's progress. Adrian, what did we learn from Mr. Griffin? Do you want to tell me about your ability to have a crystal ball?
Well, if you mean a couple of years ago, I was on this show, I think it was 2015, and at the time we were talking about the National Broadband Plan and its idea and what it was aimed to do, and there was a bit of controversy at the time, and you asked the question right at the end of the programme, if you were to name a year when you think this will actually be delivered, I said 2023. And there were groans around the studio at the time because it was 8, 9 years off. I actually think that's looking bang on now at the moment. So
that must make you feel good about things.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all, because I'm a regular visitor to around the country.
Right.
And like everybody else, I've been tearing my hair out for the last few years.
But so what did we learn this week?
A few things. So as you mentioned, the Public Accounts Committee in the Oireachtas heard from the Department of Communications officials, the Secretary General there, Mark Griffin, Fergal Mulligan and a few other officials, and they essentially laid out what was going on. They were asked about things like cost. They were asked about things like, did it have to be fibre, fixed fibre, and not wireless or 5G, for example? They were asked all of these questions.
Yeah.
They set out a very, very strong case as to why, A, it should go ahead, and B, why it should be fibre, fixed line fibre, running into the house. Not masts, not antennas, not wireless, not 4G or 5G.
Why not?
Because
I live in a rural area, yeah, and there's no question of getting something into the house, just not possible. But
so do you have an antenna on the roof? Is that the way yours works?
Fixed wireless. Out the back,
Back, right.
Yeah.
So the problem...
We've Netflix and...
You've Netflix, you've got email, you can do, your revenue. That's all fine for today in 2019. If I was guessing, I'd say that the broadband speed you're getting is somewhere between 10 and 30 megabits per second, somewhere around that. That's enough to do those things. It will absolutely not be enough to do the things you need to do in 5 or 10 years' time. So when we talk about broadband in rural areas, we're not talking about binging on Netflix or, just gaming nonstop all the time. We're talking about things that we know are coming down the line, like health services, like security services. I mean, I'll give you a small example. During the week, Apple updated the software for its Apple Watch to enable it with an ECG to detect atrial fibrillation, irregular heartbeats. Now, Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, has said many times that he thinks that company's future lies as much in health services as it does in phones, hardware, and music and movies and all the rest of it. It's absolutely likely that in 5 or 10 years' time, the average person living in a rural area will have a lot of sensors in their house. They'll have health and medical kit and machines to know what's going on. They'll have a lot of security stuff. I write a column every week in the newspaper, and one of the most common emails or letters I get is, my parent lives in an isolated area. He or she has problems with security. We're trying to find a connected web camera or a security camera, but there's no 4G signal and there's no broadband. Now, that sort of service in the city, we have those. Our houses are filling up with those kind of machines and systems. That's the kind of thing that's going to be normal in modern life, not just binging on Netflix. You're going to need broadband, for research, to work, but also to live in a normal modern household.
Right.
So that's really what this is about.
And why do some people say, oh, listen, before we spend all that money, 5G is coming down the track? What's the significance of that?
The significance, first to explain what 5G is, at the moment when you look at your phone, it will probably have a little symbol at the top of it which will say either 3G or 4G. In some rural areas, you mightn't even get either. The difference there basically is that if you have a 4G signal and you have a reasonable signal, you can download things on your phone, you can stream things, you can access the web relatively quickly. The next phase is 5G, 3G, 4G, and now we're having 5G. The the main difference between 5G and 4G is that, yes, A, it's faster, but also it's capable of connecting things much, much quicker. So, for example, go back to my example previously with the rural home.
Yeah.
Maybe it has 10 or 20 connected devices, all sorts of medical devices, maybe some entertainment devices, security devices. Imagine even the era of connected cars, of self-driving cars, which is coming, by the way, about 10 years down the line. For all of those things to work safely, quickly and reliably, you need more than a 4G signal, even a strong one. You need a 5G signal. So that's what 5G is. The problem in Ireland is that whereas 4G has had a 70% population license requirement, so they've hit 70% of the population,
yeah,
which is basically just the cities, by the way.
Right.
There is no requirement yet articulated for 5G, and a lot of the papers published by the regulator, telecoms regulator, Comreg, which essentially sets this license requirement,
yeah,
suggests that they shouldn't, that we won't be going for a universal geographical 5G requirement. Now, this is something the government actually promised a couple of years ago, that when 5G came about, there would be a geographic requirement. So it wouldn't just be, you know, 10% of the landmass in Dublin, Cork, Waterford, Limerick, and Galway.
Yeah.
Would be all over the place. That's not going to happen. So if you don't have a requirement to have 5G throughout the majority of the country, you know, then you can't rely on it. I mean, you can't rely on private operators just to build it out where they want.
Yeah. The lead story in the Sunday Times today, green light for $3 billion. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
Rural web.
Now, I would just to parse that figure. The original estimate was $500 million 7 years ago when Pat Rabbit announced.
Yeah.
I was there at the announcement. Mark Griffin, the Secretary General of Department of Communications, broke that figure down because he was asked specifically, how have we gotten from $500 million to, you know, Taoiseach has said a multiple. $2 billion, maybe $3 billion. How has that happened? He said the original $500 million estimate was based on running some fibre lines to villages from where the normal phone line or a wireless connection would take over. That seemed fine in 2012, when really all we wanted to do was to send emails and look up
and
Google.
And invoices.
It
and,
is
yeah.
absolutely totally different now. So the solution that they're talking about now is not only to run the fibre to the villages, but to run it out to every single home in the townland, okay? It, like electricity lines.
Yeah.
Okay? And that's the way.
And wasn't there a point at which they were going to run them through the electricity lines?
Well, if they may still do that. The conventional wisdom is that these will run essentially along the telephone poles, along Ayr's telephone
yeah.
poles. There will be some new poles and some new ducts built. But in scenarios where you have a farm, for example, it might be that the telephone poles are coming from the wrong direction to the rest of the network, and they may use the ESB infrastructure.
Yeah.
So that may still happen.
That's already been used, Ciro.
With Ciro, yeah. The ESB and Vodafone,
ESB and Vodafone. I have that, actually.
Of course, you're a former...
Well, I changed to that, and I have fibre into my home, which is amazing. But I've always believed, as a former Minister for Communications, that there would be a digital divide if we didn't get it into the rural areas. But how do you get it into the rural areas? Spreading our statistics for laneways and small roads is we've the highest, the lowest level of population per road in all of Europe. So it's difficult getting wires down to little boreens.
Yeah.
And it has been a constant battle for the last decade and a half. Technology, I think, will ultimately solve it. May not solve it for everybody, but the 5G, obviously, and I think Adrian, I just came in on the end of his comments, that will be the solution, in my view, some sort of mobile satellite, but it will have to be forced because he's right, the private companies will not do it unless they get a direction from government and obviously funding from government in some way.
But Dermot mentions there the digital divide. Unfortunately, we already have a digital divide.
I absolutely accept that
this plan has gone from, and it has been explained how it's gone from 500 million to to potentially 3 billion is very, very worrying because, as the Taoiseach even indicated in the Dáil a few weeks ago, we have to, when it gets to multiples of what they originally anticipated, you have to look at the balance sheet, you have to look at exchequer money, whether it becomes value for money, whether it becomes even possible. And he even alluded to Brexit and how we may or may not be even able to afford this. And I know, Adrian, you mentioned 2023. Yeah. At this stage, I'd be very optimistic about pessimistic about 2023 and whether everyone will have it rolled out by that stage.
Well, not everyone, but there's no question that if they start, if they give it the green light in a month's time and they start building it, rolling out by the end of the year, there's no question the majority there would have it by 2023. The word value, by the way, is absolutely crucial in this whole debate, because how do you measure whether this is worth 500 million or 3 billion? Is this electricity for the whole country? Mm. Is it to be valued like that? Or is this some kind of sort of add-on luxury, like a lot of people try to frame it? Now, that is a real key issue in this debate. Mm. Is this something that is necessary for the country, or is it some sort of just, is it a luxury?
Yeah, well,
a lot of urban commentators will say, oh no, sure, they don't need broadband.
Yeah, well, rural Ireland would say that creation of jobs is not a luxury, and whether you can work in Cahir or Sighvín or you have to go up to Dublin to work, that's not a luxury.
Well, one of the things that has cost us a fortune is hesitation. If you think of the Children's Hospital, the number of iterations that went through, and there's no doubt that elapsed time per se adds to the cost. And back in the 90s, I facilitated two commissions on the future of telecoms and e-commerce. The language tells you how quaint it was back then. And one of the things that the civil servants who were advocating that we bring fibre into Wexford from the cable that was being put across the Atlantic, the accusation against the civil servants was that this is speculative infrastructure. You know, we'll have it and nobody will ever use it. And I think in this case, we have to give credit to the civil servants who are saying, this is what we need. Give us the decision. Because in parallel with Adrian, the whole broadband thing, it just coincidentally, I'm working on a project with senior nurses on what's called the digitization of nursing and health. And Adrian is absolutely right. You will not recognize the health system when digitization occurs. You will be in your own home, you'll have handheld devices which will give all your diagnostics into central sites. They'll be read back. There's a lot of autonomy in managing your own. I mean, it's just, you know, to use the phrase, space age things already in train in the healthcare area. And for those, you will need fibre.
Right.
Okay,
Bridget, do you want to come in?
It is the electricity of our time. It's not an add-on. It's not a luxury. And also we should think about, there will be lots of people who'll want to work remotely from beautiful parts of the country. Quality of life, better housing.
Like Skibbereen.
Cheaper housing.
Also, can I say, as a Cahir Sighvín woman, that Valencia's already attracting people, including Americans, who want to work remotely, and they love working in places like South Kerry. So I think this is not a luxury, and I absolutely, Adrian's framing of the fact that a lot of urbanites think that this is something for the cities and not for the rural areas, it is essential to the 21st century. Basta.
And it's in the interest of the urbanites as well. Urbanites will benefit from balanced regional development.
Absolutely.
Anybody who jumps in a car in Dublin will tell you that. Yeah. This is
housing.
One part of the solution to a lot of those.
Well, Adrian, from that meeting the other day, did you get a sense that there has been a decision made? Now, they say here, green light for 3 billion rural web.
Yeah.
Did you?
So what was clear from the PAC gathering was that the department, almost to a person, are strongly in favour of this, are pushing for it to be adopted. They've spent years working on it. The minister, Richard Bruton, is probably in strongly in favour of it as well. They are essentially trying to present this to the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, who, as you say, did raise, he a few weeks ago tried to suggest that maybe because of Brexit or the national or mistakes with the National Children's Hospital, that we might need to think about this again. The department are clearly in favour of this. I think, having followed the issue for many years, that over the last few months, there was a kind of a rearguard attempt in some areas of government to put the brakes on it, to suggest that maybe we don't need it, that maybe it might be too
expensive.
What
did Mark Griffin say?
Mark Griffin said that
the Secretary General,
he laid a very, very strong case as to why he thinks if the policy decision is for Ireland to be a modern broadband connected country, this is the way to do it. He said it very, very clearly.
And as we all, with sinking hearts, hear about projects that go from 500 million to billions.
Now, to be fair, Mark Griffin addressed that point because he was asked about it. And he said, look, he was asked, what's the difference between this and the National Children's Hospital?
Yeah, so I'm thinking.
And he said the difference is that with the National Children's Hospital, the cost estimate started to escalate wildly after construction was started. That was where the surprise cost escalation was. With the National Broadband Plan, they're going to provide a cost before a sod is turned, and that will be the cost. And the contract, the way it's written, has all sorts of clawbacks and provisos in it.
Right.
That means there can't be that kind of variation.
Right. But what's the situation in Italy, by the way?
Well, Tuscany, where I live, is a very, very well-run province of Italy. So there's excellent broadband, that's all I
everywhere.
Can say. But Italy is really very different depending on where you are.
Right. And indeed, depending on where you are here, I seem to recall you telling me at one stage, Dermot Ahern, that if you answered the phone in the living room or if you made a call from your kitchen...
This is the Brexit issue again.
Yes, and the roaming.
Yeah, I mean, at the start of mobile phones, depending on what room I went into in my house, I would be welcome to the UK and welcome to the Republic of Ireland. And I used to tell this when I was Minister for Communications to the conferences, that, you know, and I got a great laugh.
Yeah.
But then I said, yes, but it's all very well for you because I'm paying roaming charges for this every time it happens. And people said, oh, yeah. And that is potentially one of what I call the unknown unknowns arising from Brexit that, you know, the people in Brussels will not address and yet will affect us potentially again in border areas in a no-deal scenario.
Well, funnily enough,
the point of what's it like in Italy, I'm a bit of a techie. I was in that department. I was telling the story before we came in that the forestry people were very annoyed because any available money I had, I was putting into the broadband area. This is back in the early 2000s. And they sarcastically said the minister was more interested in broadband than broadleaf, which I have to admit was correct. When I go abroad, I do a speed test on the broadband and Wi-Fi in every area I go to. And I have to say, by and large, I hear all this that Ireland is way, way behind. And I know there will be people down on me who'd say, well, we live in Caherzavina, wherever we can. Generally speaking, you know, we're not as bad as we make ourselves out to be.
You see that on the train to Belfast. If you're on the train from Dublin to Belfast, you will be, your phone signal will drop off the minute you go into the north. We've a far better,
really?
Oh, we've a far better mobile signal in the cities, in the urban areas here, way better.
Yeah, and quite a lot of European countries, when you go outside the cities, it's exactly the same. You know, the problem ultimately is, and the danger I see here is that, and I hear what you say about, you know, the department and all of that. It's a small department, very small budget. This is a decision that the government, it's a bit like the National Hospital, they will have to earmark special funds for this particular project. Mm-hmm. And the thing I would fear is that they'll get to a certain stage and no further will we go. And it's no further will we go. They're the last 100,000 people who live down at the very end of a little boreen down in Caherzavina who will not get it.
Even if that were to happen, that would mean that the bulk of the 1 million people at the moment, the 540,000 households, would still be connected.
There.
We'd be in a much better position than we are now.
But you're adamant that getting Wi-Fi it won't do the business.
Wireless. Mobile. So, in other words, like wireless or 5G, you need to build way more masts. There'd need to be masts almost everywhere for that to happen. If it rained, when the leaves budded on the trees, if the wind blew, there's all sorts of variables with wireless.
We used to lose 5G. Our phone when it rained.
Yeah. So it is a solution. There are many very, very good wireless solutions around Ireland today. I mean, I go to Mayo, to Belmullet quite a lot. We don't have broadband there, but for some weird reason, there's actually a good Vodafone 4G signal. So I stick my phone in the window, put it onto mobile hotspot, and we can run a laptop off that. But you couldn't do that if you were living there.
You couldn't use the kind of equipment that Eddie's talking about.
You could use that equipment.
Could you?
You could, but not for a normal average family household with a couple of kids. In Ireland, for example, the average amount of data, not to blind everybody with science, the average amount of data that a normal household uses is 170 gigabytes using like a normal broadband, good broadband connection. On a wireless broadband connection, the average is 20 gigabytes. It's a tiny fraction. You don't get the same capacity.
Right.
And that is going to be a big, big issue as more of the things, the normal things in our house become connected.
Right. Just by the way, Mark Zuckerberg, the article in the Sender today, did you think? First of all, will you say what it was?
Yeah, so Mark Zuckerberg, he wrote ourselves, the Sunday Independent, the Washington Post, and two European newspapers, and he set out his thoughts on what he thinks needs to happen now with things like data privacy and regulation. He said, for me, he said two surprising things. Number one, he said that we have too much power. He said, we've too much power for free speech.
Yeah, and I thought that was
I thought it was very interesting. And, we want governments and regulators to start regulating us better, which is kind of extraordinary. If you were a cynic, you might say, yes, that's because we have one of the biggest regulatory teams in the world now, and we'll be able to handle it, and the small players who are our rivals won't. You might say that.
Yeah.
The second thing he said of interest was that he wants the GDPR, which is the European Data Privacy Law we've all heard so much about, which came into effect last year, he wants that extended to countries like the US and around the world. So he's either trying to get ahead of the regulation, or he's trying to sort of come across as being, you know, not the creepy data slurper that he's sometimes portrayed as. But it was interesting that he placed that article in Sunday Independent, the Washington Post, a French newspaper and a German newspaper. He's trying to reach policymakers with those, with those placements.
Yeah. I wouldn't fancy his chances in America, would you? I mean, you know America so well.
No. Facebook and Google spend as much or more on lobbying in Washington than almost anyone else now at this point. They still have an uphill battle on almost everything they fight. You have Elizabeth Warren, who's one of the presidential candidates, saying that she wants to break up the tech companies. She's treating them as antitrust issues.
Right.
That's why Europe is actually really important here, because it's the only other part of the world that has the heft to regulate them and tax the big techs.
Yep.
And both need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how they've reacted to the GDPR, having tried to lobby to water it down. I mean, they've accepted it now.
Well, they have to.
They absolutely
have to. I mean, in Ireland, the Data Protection Commissioner, Helen Dixon, 10 of her 15 statutory inquiries under GDPR that she's opened in the last 8 months relate to Facebook, Instagram or WhatsApp, the same company. Mm-hmm. So
by saying what he's saying, is he not trying to put a bit of an onus on governments to in effect, censors of what goes out?
Yeah.
You know, it depends how you look at that question. That's the perennial issue. Is this an issue of
censorship.
Safety or censorship or free speech? Mm. How do you frame this issue? In fairness, we ourselves can't really fully agree on that.
No. There was a piece in the Irish Times yesterday, very difficult to read it, about the people in Facebook who are monitoring what's coming in and some of the stuff they have to look at.
It is dreadful.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Now, what Mark Zuckerberg said, first of all, they're dealing with the reputation now of being digital gangsters.
Yeah.
California, for instance, is opting for the European thing. But Zuckerberg makes a key point in the article that I read in today's Independent. It is, he can only ban people. He can only block them. But he can't impose penalties. Only the state can pursue you. In other words, if you put some of this terrible stuff on the web, they can block
you. Talking to somebody whose job it was recently,
dreadful stuff.
We have a digital safety commissioner that has been announced by Richard Bruton, announced that 6 weeks ago, and that position will probably be in place by the end of this year or the beginning of next. It's thought to be loosely modelled on the Australian digital safety commissioner. It'll be a small office. I don't think it will solve issues like that.
No.
The problem with that sort of stuff is that we live in, you know, an era where you can post things on the internet, and it's very difficult.
She was going through the amount of stuff that goes on the internet, that goes through Facebook, more or less per second, right across the world. It's a big task to monitor that. I mean, from somebody that was formerly in a chair that might have landed on your desk. I mean, it seems so mammoth that it's impossible. I know that's a defeatist attitude, but
I would have thought, given the, you know, the internet, that it's worldwide. And I'm not sure if governments can do an awful lot in relation to some of this. I mean, ultimately, the companies that operate it have a huge responsibility. Yeah.
Governments could act a bit faster, though, on this. And Adrian mentioned the Digital Safety Commissioner, that announcement from Richard Bruton only a couple of weeks ago. But when he was asked, well, when are we going to see this office put in place, he kind of reverted back to, well, it's the will of the doll, and we have to pass legislation, and couldn't give a date. And this office, this commissioner's office, has been called for many years.
15 years ago, internet safety.
Well, you can do what China does and basically ban Facebook. Well, so Facebook is not in China.
Yeah.
Okay. and that's the other
extreme.
This
is the conundrum.
The Chinese.
Where do you draw the line between censorship
and regulation, proper regulation?
Well, Digital Safety Commissioner would have the power to issue takedown orders. And we've seen in Australia, it's worked very well. And they have massive fines that they can dole out in Australia. And they haven't had the need to do it because the online companies.
You see the problems that Miriam O'Callaghan has in relation to Facebook difficulty. She has just to find out who's behind it.
We see it all the time in the media where you have stories that are published in newspapers or media organs abroad that get wide distribution in Ireland because there are 3 million people in Ireland who use Facebook, and we can't publish them or we can't refer to them for legal reasons.
Are there 3 million?
3 million people in Ireland use Facebook. Right now, the way it breaks down is, if you're over the age of 35 or 40, Facebook is your go-to social media. If you want to look somebody's number up, we used to have a thing called a telephone book. I'm not sure if you remember it, right? Nowadays, you put the name in Facebook to see if you can find them. After that, you have Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, WhatsApp. Instagram and WhatsApp are both owned by Facebook. So when people say, well, that's it, I'm sick of Facebook, I'm sick of what Mark Zuckerberg is doing, I'm only going to use WhatsApp from now on.
The other area we can't forget is the safety of elections. That's a huge problem
now.
I mean, the use of by the disruptor Putin and the use to which they put social media in terms of directly interfering and impacting elections in different countries.
You saw what Facebook announced a few days ago with their paid for by. Yeah. So for the European elections, anyone who places a political advertisement on Facebook now has to put a sticker on it. And it has to show who paid for it. It has to also show who the ad was aimed at by population, gender, age, all sorts of details. So they're trying to clean their act up.
Yeah, they
know they have a very soft underbelly there.
Yeah, and I mean, you have the European elections coming up, and I presume there are all sorts of people trying to figure out how to put this to good use. Connor?
Just one interesting aside here. I thought it's kind of noteworthy that the platform that Mark Zuckerberg uses here is traditional media.
Yes.
It underlines the credibility and the trust and the reputation of traditional media when you really want to capture the attention of policymakers.
Well, he chose the Washington Post instead of the New York Times. He chose the Sunday Independent, probably because it's the biggest circulation, right? He chose in France and Germany, the two most critical countries of the GAFA, of the Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple. They're the entities because they're the people he wants to reach.
It's all happening so fast as well, isn't that the thing? But mind you, we hope for the sake of rural Ireland that this goes fast as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure there are people listening to this program right now who are screaming at the radio and saying, this is not about me wanting to binge on Netflix. This is simply about me. I have a college student here. They cannot actually study at home. I have to give them the car to drive
into
the library, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or drive out to a crossroads somewhere where there'll be a signal.
Yeah, a good signal,
And that happens to businesses as well. I know about them in County Longford. Anyway, we leave that there for a moment and we take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio. This spring, re-energise your home improvement projects at Homebase with 3 for 2 on all clan-coloured emulsion and Santex masonry paint. And for 6 days only, petrol 40cm Sovereign lawnmower down from €179 to €140. Explore the possibilities at Homebase. Excludes Pure Brilliant White Mix and Match, cheapest item free in-store only.
Hearsay International Audio Festival brings the world's finest creators of podcasts, film sound, radio documentaries and sound art from 32 countries to the mountain village of Kilfinan, County Limerick, April 4th to 7th. Hearsay 19 will include 100 events held everywhere from living rooms to apple farms featuring the craft of audio, provocations, performances and magical audio encounters. See hearsayfestival.ie, supported by the Arts Council.
RTE, supporting the arts.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco, where even the little things make all the difference. Tesco, every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, just briefly, I'm going to go to another story that was on the front of the Sunday Times today, which is Gorda body rejects switch of 500 desk jobs to frontline policing. Now, Eddie, since you were on that commission, I think it was called, did that surprise you as a story?
No, not whatsoever. There go back 2 or 3 years, there are, I think there were 1,500 Garda positions, Gardas behind desks.
Yeah.
Specific jobs and roles, they were listed and named as being able to be done by civilians, as they call non-sworn members.
Yeah.
At the same time as that, every commentator on policing says you've got to get the police out on the beat, physically present,
yeah,
and so on,
to
reassure people, yeah, and make them feel safe, etc. And the whole new emphasis in the commission's report on community policing and all that that means.
Yeah.
So it was no surprise, and I had heard from other things I'm involved in, that the recruitment process is now in train
it's that they reject. Yeah,
the Garda unions are rejecting it. Well, if you think of it,
if you were a guard, you'd prefer to be out doing your guarding work.
You'd much prefer to have a 9-to-5 job in an office, to be in an office, to have your week, and it wouldn't be rostered that much, for example. Clerical work.
Right.
And one of the first things that the new Commissioner Drew Harris stamped out was a certain type of overtime, and that created howls from the Garda representatives. And when he was asked on that, he said it's discretionary administrative overtime, which is guards coming in on a Sunday to do paperwork. Probably time and a half and so on. So, no, it's no surprise, Mary.
Right.
You
weren't surprised either, Dermot.
I wouldn't have been surprised. No, because there would always be, there would always be a difficulty about getting guards out of offices and into their cars and on the beat, preferably, rather than in the cars. It's human nature. There has been a bit of a seed change in the Gardaí itself, in that, you know, there's substantial numbers, I'm not being sexist when I say this, of females who, you know, gravitate towards the offices rather than out on the beat, mainly because of safety reasons, you know.
Oh, safety. I thought you were going to say children.
It was one of the reasons why we brought in pepper spray, and when we reduced the height of guards, the minimum requirement.
Yeah.
We had to implement pepper spray, mainly because a lot of smaller guards, male and female, were going into situations where, you know, they would be in severe danger.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised that I would think it's a constant battle for the Garda management to get people out.
So what would you say is going to be the outcome of this?
Oh, I'd say the outcome is it will happen.
Yeah,
you know, I think that there are certain kind of non-negotiables in this, and I don't think it's something that the guards can simply resist. Now, you know, we had a situation there a year and a half ago where the guards were prepared to literally go on strike when they took a stand on something. They couldn't do it on this. And the other thing about it, by the way, I mean, the average remuneration for a Garda is, you know, around 70,000 or more than 70,000. It was close 68,000 around about 2016.
That's across the range.
Not across the grades, not across the ranks. Garda.
All right.
Garda, okay.
Yeah.
And the clerical, you could have very well paid clerical people doing the work for, you know, less than that. So I think there are big cost implications as right. well in this.
I think the general public on this would be baffled, if not a bit annoyed, that Gardaí are up in arms about the fact that they've been asked to do what they were trained to do in the first place. It'd be a bit like a teacher saying, I don't want to go into a classroom. You know, it just doesn't make sense, really.
Yeah. I think sometimes they feel like that. You might know that, Bridget, better. Since, yeah. Can I come back to you, James Aaron? Was when you were in Justice that you were dealing with Theresa May when she was in the Home Office?
Yes.
And can you tell us a little bit of that? To give us an insight into personality?
I was going to Brussels for 14 and a half years in different ministries on a fortnightly, weekly basis. And we would have used, and it's still the same, our personal contacts with people in different ministries, and we would make friends. And it's one of the reasons why over the years we've been pretty successful at negotiations at the EU level. And you always got personal relations, tried to. Injustice was very difficult because... it comes to something that Eddie would appreciate, that, you know, the Minister for Justice in Ireland is, at the moment, is involved in everything, state security, local policing, immigration, so on and so forth,
right.
counter-terrorism. Whereas in Europe, in some countries, they have three ministers for justice, one for immigration, one for home affairs, and so on. In the UK... Theresa May was Home Secretary, basically looking after home affairs and immigration. And when around the time in mid 2010, we had a huge issue here with arranged bogus marriages, where the guards showed, and I see it's still a problem. People from outside the EU, men coming here to marry. Eastern Europeans who were legally here under the EU rules. In fact, one Latvian paper at the time was advertising the service where Latvian women would marry mainly Pakistani men. 400, apparently, Pakistani men married 400 Latvian women in 2010. I kept raising it at the EU meetings, and I was getting no support around the table except from, in fairness, a Danish female minister who was brilliant. But the Brits didn't help me at all, and Theresa May didn't go to any of the EU meetings.
Did she not?
No, she didn't turn up when I was there. To such an extent, eventually my officials said to me, Minister, you're going to have to go to London to meet her, which I did. And I met her, and we discussed that and a number of other issues. And I came away, I have to say, not particularly impressed with her as a person. I remember meeting later that day the Justice Minister, who was Ken Clark, who is extremely entertaining and great company and a great fan of Ireland. And it was a much better meeting. You might have seen recently, or about 2 years ago, he got into awful trouble when off mic he referred to Theresa May as a bloody difficult woman. Mm. Well, how right he was.
Yeah, well, she was happy to take
Yeah, but I felt that, given what I've read about her, I know more about her now, because that she, you know, one of her big issues is immigration. And immigration, not necessarily from outside the EU, from
Eastern Europe.
From Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And here she was, completely, and her officials, obviously, at her direction, not really taken with this issue of people circumventing our and their, potentially, immigration rules, using Ireland as a backdoor to get into Britain because of the common travel area. I just found it intriguing, but it's still an issue.
But she was always gung-ho, I believe, on immigration. She didn't like it.
Yeah, well, but she only sent the immigration junior minister during my time.
What do you think that says?
I don't know. Jack Straw was her predecessor, and I knew him from Foreign Affairs, and he attended all of the meetings of Justice, and then she took over, and she didn't appear. And in fairness, that was the middle of 2010, and I was gone in early 2011.
Yeah, so. But would you think that was indicative of an attitude to immigration or an attitude to Europe?
I would suspect Europe, I have to say, because, you know, I mean, it goes back to the Brexit issue. They called a referendum, albeit advisory.
Yeah.
How did the politicians expect the people to vote to stay in Europe when they themselves, at every forum, dumped on the EU project? In my experience, I very rarely heard, apart from maybe Douglas Alexander, who I remember, and Tony Blair, being positive about Europe. And yet this is a country who, you know, I would have thought, given the fact that they used to fight the Germans and the French across the barricades in Europe, that it would be better for them to be talking with the French and German across the table.
Well, they don't
see it like that. The whole business. But they were very negative. I mean, they were incredibly negative. They blamed Brussels for everything. And I know there was a tendency here in Ireland to blame Brussels for everything.
Yes, there was, yeah.
But, you know, I think Irish people were able to rise above that and see that there were benefits.
I'm not sure about that. You know, if a minister found something uncomfortable, you blame Brussels, even though you'd have signed off on it.
Generally speaking, but I think, you know, people were able to rise above, you know, the straight bananas issue and all those stupid things to see that there were benefits of having us all around the table and having disagreements around the table rather than on the green fields of France.
Yeah. And that's all been forgotten now, what the project was about at the very beginning, which was post-war.
It's interesting you mentioned post-war. I mean, somebody gave me Tony Judd's book, Post-War, The History of Europe Since the Second War. And it's a must-read. And somebody gave it to me and said, read the first three chapters of this and realise what an achievement the EU was. I mean, you asked about Italy. Mm. Italy couldn't feed itself. You know, 90% of the railways were destroyed, etc. And Barack Obama said that the European Union was one of the greatest human achievements of all time. And it's interesting, you know, the other thought that occurs to me on this is the idea that we would remove history from our curriculum. I mean, it's quite evident in Britain that they don't even know their recent history, the last 50 years.
Well, they do know their own history. I think what has been reflected is how little they know about Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Now, the UK supporters of Northern Ireland would say, well, we're UK and as the argument is going on at the moment. But I thought it was very interesting to hear the Brexiteers who sounded like they knew nothing about Northern Ireland, but they knew their own history.
But how could you not know it? If you're in Britain and you're an educated person, how could you not, if you're in your 50s or 60s, how could you not know about Northern Ireland?
If you went in recent times to the UK and tendered a Northern Ireland sterling note, they'd throw it back at you.
Right,
so they won't take it.
There's two things that British politics have never been able to handle: the Irish question and their relationship with Europe. And the two are now one. Mm. And it's an almighty mess.
Right.
Can't handle it.
Okay, can I just say that Richard Bruton's were on to say that the consultation period on the online safety commissioner, opened in early March, is due to run for 6 weeks. Draft heads of a bill will be brought to Cabinet very shortly after that. And a GRA source quoted as saying the GRA would oppose plans by the Garda Commissioner to redeploy 500 Gardaí from desk to frontline duties on the grounds that civilians might, they say, end up investigating crime and carrying out other operational police tasks. So we'll take another break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.